as we just heard, Chancellor Merkel in Germany doesn't believe countries can spend their way out of the current economic crisis. She's worried massive government spending could unleash runaway inflation. It's a fear that recalls a painful episode in Germany's economic history. David Kestenbaum of NPR's Planet Money team explains.
Let me describe one piece of paper for you. It's German currency from 1923. It says 50 million marks on it. This one piece of paper was worth 50 million marks. Germany underwent what is now the textbook case of hyperinflation. It happened just after the First World War. Germany had debts to pay, and it had gotten into that bad habit of basically printing money.
In October 1923, it was noted by the British Embassy in Berlin that the number of marks to the pound equaled the number of yards from the earth to the sun.
This is an actor reading from a history called When Money Dies, The Nightmare of the Weimar Collapse by Adam Ferguson.
Dr. Schacht, Germany's National Currency Commissioner, explained that at the end of the Great War, one could, in theory, have bought 500 billion eggs for the same price as that for which, 5 years later, only a single egg could be procured.
And some people worry we might be heading for inflation soon. The amount of money in an economy is determined by its central bank. The central bank is supposed to be independent of politics. In this current crisis, the Federal Reserve, our central bank, and central banks around the world have been taking unprecedented historic steps to make credit available, to basically push money into the economy. The head of Germany's central bank has warned this could lead to inflation. And here is Chancellor Angela Merkel earlier this month.
We must return to an independent central bank policy and to a policy of reason. Otherwise, in 10 years' time, we'll be in exactly the same situation.
Merkel worried the central banks might be bowing to political pressure and losing their independence. Joseph Joffe is editor of the German newspaper Die Zeit. He says concern about inflation is in the German DNA. It's in his. He worries there's just too much money in the economy.
Tim Geithner and Bernanke and the president and Larry Summers think they can soak it up again when the time comes. But meanwhile, they're pumping unprecedented liquidity into the American global system. And I just can only say good luck, Mr. President, in soaking up that excess liquidity. I think that's what Mrs. Merkel reacted to. I mean, if the Germans believe in one God, it's the independence of the central bank.
So are we at risk of catching a nasty case of inflation down the road? I took our U.S. economy in for a kind of doctor's office visit to a place that gives this advice out to countries all the time, the International Monetary Fund.
Carlo Cottarelli, I'm the director of the Fiscal Affairs Department of the IMF.
Grazie mille.
Prego.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose we have a country, GDP, say, around $13 trillion. Its central bank has been pushing as much money as possible into the economy. Meanwhile, the government is racking up a huge debt. Would the IMF tell this country to be worried about inflation?
I mean, what we have been telling, not this country, but all our members, is that there is a need in the short run for macroeconomic policies to support economic activity. But there is a need for every central bank and for every government to have a strategy, to start thinking now about how to exit when the moment comes.
That could be difficult, he says. Raising interest rates, pulling money back out of the economy is often unpopular. It's been said the role of a central bank is to pull away the punch bowl just as the party gets going. That time is definitely still in the future. As we all know, it's still a pretty lousy party. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
And if you'd like your own lesson on how inflation can spin out of control, visit our Planet Money website at npr.org/money.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to straightforward banking. At allybank.com, visitors can compare bank rates all in one place with Ally's rate comparison tool.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. General Electric may be best known for light bulbs and refrigerators, but this American conglomerate is a worldwide giant in everything from energy to transportation to financial services. And that has left the company vulnerable on multiple fronts during the global financial meltdown. General Electric CEO Jeff Immelt is now trying to refocus the company. He has also some ideas about how to refocus the American economy, which he elaborated on when I spoke with him yesterday. Now, you have called for something that should not be startling to hear, but in a certain way is. That is, you have called for America to start exporting more again.
Totally. You know, look, I think the U.S. consumer almost can't be, you know, the sole engine of economic growth the way they've been probably for the last 20 or 25 years. And for this economy to recover fully, it's got to be led by business investment, and it's got to be led by exports. The types of trade deficits we have as a country, the erosion of the manufacturing base in the country, these are things that are going to have to be fixed, and companies like GE are going to have to invest, and we need the government to really have a very keen focus that restoring the competitiveness of the country, particularly in places where we can be a great exporter, is really important.
I know a huge part of your business at GE is outside the United States, something like half.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about exporting, just give us an example. I mean, you know, manufacturing wind turbines, would that be the sort of thing you're talking about?
You know, I would talk about jet engines. There's a big air show that took place in Paris a week or so ago. In the depths of this recession, we got bigger orders than any time in our history. And not one of the orders was from an airline in the United States. These are from Etihad Airlines in Abu Dhabi, airlines in Canada. And these are all products that are fundamentally going to be manufactured in the U.S. We recently put a hybrid water heater, 50% energy savings, back into our facility in Louisville, Kentucky. This was a product that could have been made in Mexico, maybe made in China. But working with our unions, we were able to make it competitively here. And, you know, I think inside the company, we're doing real decision-making about have we outsourced too much capability in areas? And if so, what should we bring back and where should we put it?
You know, when you talk, though, about manufacturing inside the United States and you're making it work in some areas, how exactly do you make it work when you talk about making deals with unions? Are they offering big concessions?
Again, I think a lot of it has to do with the technology, the products that you're building. So if you have high-tech products where the science and material science is a big part of the cost component, the U.S. can compete with anybody. But it's also important to work with your human resources and your talent, and that means work roles. It means more productivity. We've had a pretty good track record working constructively with the human resources to have the types of products that can be exported.
But does that involve lower labor costs?
You know, I think what it involves is in the places where you have relatively high labor costs, they've got to be more productive. And it's got to involve real work on technology. And just the output of the labor that you've got in any one of the facilities has to be able to compete on a global basis.
Although, of course, Americans are among the most productive in the world, workers.
American workers are among the most productive in the world. But if you want to sell your locomotives in China, you've got to make sure that you can compete with people that manufacture in China.
Should the government play a role in this at all, providing subsidies, tax incentives, the sort of things that countries like Japan and South Korea have done?
The government should do whatever's in its own best interest, you know, over time. My sense is that there should be a real definitive desire to make the country more competitive and to try to make sure that we can export more because that's where the growth is going to be.
Are you reshaping a substantial part of the business in order to gain a bigger share of government stimulus money?
We are a huge energy player. So we're a $45 billion energy player. We're about a $20 billion healthcare player. These are businesses we've been in for almost 100 years. That's the lion's share of the company. And so insofar as there's going to be government stimulus that is in energy and healthcare, GE is a natural player for those types of investment because we've invested in R&D for decades.
Jack Welch, your predecessor, was quoted as saying that taking government money was, and I'm quoting him, making a deal with the devil. Now, he was referring to banks taking government bailout funds, quite a different thing from stimulus money. But are you concerned that going after, say, massive amounts of stimulus money will make GE too dependent on the government?
If, in fact, the government is doing financing of wind turbines or jet engines or things like that, I think I owe it to our employees and to our customers and to our investors to make sure GE is well positioned for that. But if all that ended, we just go back to the way we run the business anyhow, and that's what we're prepared to do. But I think it's just an IQ test to say if China is going to rebuild its healthcare system, GE should try to grow our healthcare business in China as fast as we can. And so it's not just about the U.S. It's about what's going on around the world. And I would say, look, we've had NASA, we've had defense spending, we've had NIH investment. We've had all those things over decades in this country. This is nothing new.
Jeff Immelt is CEO of General Electric. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
The recession has changed Wall Street, and this summer we'll look at how it's changing the lives of people who worked there. We begin in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Ridgewood is a tidy bedroom community about 25 miles north of New York City. Business Week recently listed it as one of the several dozen places that would be hit hardest by the financial crisis. That's because one in six residents in Ridgewood work in finance or real estate. Many built their lives on Wall Street. Now their future is uncertain. And David Green, you're our guest host this week, but you also paid a visit to Ridgewood.
I did. It was actually last week, Renee, and I took the train there from Manhattan. It's about a 25-minute ride or so. Okay, and there's a little sound of the trip that I wanted to play for you.
American Line to Ridgewood! Ridgewood!
So that sounds like one of those classic bedroom suburbs. Tell us what it looked like.
That's exactly what it is. There's the commuter train station that everyone knows very well, and it's really the center of town. And there's this street, Ridgewood Avenue, that runs away from the train station, past, you know, flower shops, jewelry stores.
And then you have a bank here. Post office is right there.
This is one of my tour guides, Renee. His name is Gus Lanis, and he's owned a diner right in town called the Daily Treat for 40 years. And Lanis has his regular crowd that comes in every morning.
Like 6 o'clock, they know each other. It's like a group, you know. And one day somebody doesn't show up, hey, what happened, you know? Second day does show up, then we call them up.
And David, you always find the diners first, but what are your other impressions? Did you get a sense that life had really change there?
Well, that's why I wanted to play you some sound of Main Street and the train, you know, to give you a sense of what life is normally like. And my impression is just how much these sounds were ingrained in people for years. This was the routine, this commute. You walked up Ridgewood Avenue, stopped for coffee, a paper, said hi to your conductor, got on the train, went to the city, came home at night. And now for some people, this routine is just gone. And instead of these sounds of the train in the morning, a group of men that I met hear this.
Almighty and most merciful Father,
we have heard.
This is a morning prayer session at St. Elizabeth's Episcopal Church in Ridgewood.
We have followed too much the devices and desires of our own hearts.
And Renee, this is a weekday morning about 8:30 a.m.
So rush hour.
Exactly. It's rush hour, and it's when a man named Kenneth Wyman would have been at work on Wall Street by this time of morning. And now that he's out of work, his days are just so different.
Just trying to have some type of routine, but it's not the routine I want. So I started to read to a bathroom that I wanted to do, and you know, just keep the yard up, just to be doing something.
And so Wyman's 54 years old, and he worked for 25 years on the floor as a member of the New York Stock Exchange. And now, once a week, he comes here to this church to be part of a fellowship group. And the group's called Men in Transition. It started up last year to help people in Ridgewood deal with losing jobs or the struggle to find new jobs. And the group is open only to men. And Wyman says that's made it easier to be open.
Being the breadwinner, or the notion of the conception of that we've always had growing up. And to start talking in front of a woman about that, maybe they don't see it the same way we do.
So I sat in on this group's meeting and hung around after to chat with them. The numbers vary. Sometimes it's more than a dozen. On this day, it was 5 men sitting around a table. The man to my right, Philip Serais, was a corporate financial consultant and then the CEO of a small bank. And during the meeting, he was talking about how hard it's been. He's been trying to start his own financial consulting business now, but he hasn't nailed down any clients yet.
I was running around developing opportunities, making contacts, new opportunities, new things, as if I had a staff that I could turn around and say, you follow up on this, I want you to go after that, you can do that. Those days are over. You know, I do this by myself now.
What's interesting is these guys would be the first to tell you that they don't think anybody feels sorry for them. If millions of people around the country have lost jobs in this recession, why would anyone care about a group who worked in the middle of Wall Street? And so they deal with their fears and their worries quietly in this room every week. One member sitting at the table, Robert Delaney, was also a Wall Street broker, just like Kenneth Wyman, who we heard before. And Delaney said even though the two of them live in the same town and hung out, they always kept their guard up around each other until they both sat down here for that first fellowship meeting.
And obviously, Kenny and I, were, as well as colleagues, were competitors in a face-to-face basis on the New York Stock Exchange for 20-some-odd years. And so I said to him at the end of the conversation that it was probably the most honest conversation we'd had in the whole 25 years.
What was different? I mean, was it a shared vulnerability, or was it just that the wall
was gone? There was no singing Kumbaya or anything, but it just was...
It was
about that we were no longer in the same shoes that we had been in previously. So it was much easier for us to talk like that.
And they've been spending their days in entirely new ways, doing things they never did before. Phil Cerace, that former bank CEO, told me about when a church official came to this Men in Transition fellowship group and asked if they wanted to help out and cook for a nearby homeless shelter. And the group said, yeah, let's do it. But they wanted to give the meal their own touch.
Rather than just doing the casserole bit, why don't we, you know, do a barbecue for these guys? And we'll, you know, get some chicken or whatever, and we'll barbecue it up and, you know, all of the accoutrements that go with it and what have you. And we said, okay.
And now, Renee, one member of the group had a little trouble with the cornbread.
He misread the directions. And the cornbread came out rather crispy. It was more like corn toast.
You know, David, there's an image of Wall Street executives tripping over each other wearing these dirty aprons.
Yeah, that's the image I had as well. And the man we were hearing right there, Phil Cerace, told me that it was a spectacle. But he said the group had a really good feeling after serving these meals to the homeless.
Not that it made us feel any better or that, gee, look at a good thing that we've done here. This was our way of sharing our group experience with them. And then having, you know, a little bit of a insight into their experience, you know. The sad thing, of course, was that that shelter has been in operation for a long, long time, long before the crash and this economic recession.
That little story, David, makes one wonder. Phil Cerace, this former banking CEO there, and these other men, are they optimistic about finding work again?
They don't really know how to feel right now. I should say these guys are not the super wealthy corporate executives we hear about. The median household income in Ridgewood is about $120,000. But these men made nice six-figure salaries. They have some savings, and so they're not desperate for work. But some are in their 50s, and they know they're probably never going to be on Wall Street again. So they're confused. Do they take a job that pays a lot less than they're used to in a totally new field? And, you know, their savings won't last forever, they tell me. And so some are talking about selling their homes, maybe, you know, downsizing.
What about leaving Ridgewood entirely?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the questions I really want to look at in the months ahead. Are there ripple effects from this recession that reshape a community like this? You know, if people built their lives on Wall Street and then suddenly are out of work, do they stay? Do they leave, go somewhere else, as some already have? And how does this really, you know, affect businesses in town? You know, the restaurants, the dry cleaners, really the whole economy.
And so we'll be hearing from you all through the summer on this.
Definitely, Renee. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montagne. People think of Steve Jobs not just as the chief executive of Apple. He is Apple. So when a hospital in Memphis disclosed this week that Jobs received a liver transplant because he was the sickest patient on the list, it raised new questions. One of them, should Apple have disclosed more about his condition to investors? NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Apple is famously cagey when it comes to discussing its own affairs. It goes to great lengths to keep its products secret, and it kept mum when its founder and chief cheerleader, once round-faced, appeared like a gaunt stick figure on stage during a speech last fall. Onlookers wondered aloud, had Jobs' 2004 bout with pancreatic cancer returned? Apple's share price faltered on the speculation. And months later, this January, Apple said Jobs was taking medical leave to treat what it called a hormonal imbalance. As it turns out, sometime in the last 6 months, Jobs got so sick, he catapulted to the front of the line among those awaiting liver donation at one of the major transplant hospitals. Jobs' health is, of course, cause for concern for Apple investors, but so is the way the disclosure has been handled. Yesterday, fellow corporate icon Warren Buffett told CNBC it was a mistake for Apple to withhold the fact of Jobs' surgery from shareholders.
Steve Jobs is important to Apple, and so it's a material fact. What is it? Whether he is facing serious surgery or not is a material fact.
Paul Hodgson agrees.
I think this needs to be laid squarely on the shoulders of the board at Apple.
Hodgson is a senior research associate at the Corporate Library, an independent firm that does research on corporate governance.
Basically, the board has not really communicated anything to shareholders. Shareholders had to deal with rumor, and the board should have seen that and decided that facts, whatever are available at the time, are better than rumor.
Yes, Hodgson acknowledges there are medical privacy issues, but the standards ought to be different when it comes to high-profile executives.
Becoming a CEO and exposing yourself to the kind of limelight that entails, typically, especially with a company like Apple, then privacy issues have to be dealt with very differently from private citizens.
It is a complicated and a very complex and a very tricky situation for companies to go through.
That is Jeff Lloyd, managing director at Citric & Company. It handles crisis public relations for companies, though not for Apple. To be fair, Lloyd says, Apple faced a difficult choice. Going public with non-conclusive medical information about its executive could have left investors jittery and hurt the stock price. That might have done more damage than good. But on balance, he says he advises clients to disclose as much as possible to prevent rumors from flying. Often, investors discover the truth after the fact anyway.
Then you've created a second problem. Why didn't you disclose this? Why didn't you let the shareholders know?
At the very least, Lloyd says, the board of directors should never let one person's fate control the fate of the company.
You don't accomplish what Apple has done just with one person. And I think that that is something that they need to communicate to the market and communicate to their shareholders, that this is not a one-man band.
Even executives that achieve demigod-like status, as Steve Jobs has for some, are, as they say, a perishable asset. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.